Hello and welcome to WrestleSpective. I am Jason, and with me today is a frequent guest of the show and always a friend, K. Sawyer Paul. Welcome back, sir.
It is so nice to be here in 2020.
Who
would have thought?
I know. We were doing these like 10 years ago.
We've been internet friends for 10 years.
Yeah, that's a nice feeling.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah, we haven't had a chance to interact in a long time, or, you know, just for whatever reason. I was telling you before that I have not watched a professional wrestling match that occurred since November 2016. Mm. So, and I know very little about what happened. I know Goldberg's still around. I know Shawn Michaels came back for a match. I know Daniel Bryan came back, but don't really know anything about what he did. So, I'm pretty much in the dark for wrestling for the last 3.5 years. So I may try to explore some of that at some point. Right now, we're sticking with Randy Savage, a little bit of comfort food. And that leads us to what we're talking about today from Saturday Night's main event in November 1987. It is Randy Savage against Bret the Hitman Hart. And you picked this match. So what stands out to you about this match in particular?
I picked this match for a couple of reasons, and we'll get into the details, but sort of overall 30,000-foot view away from it, it's a very rare one-on-one Bret Hart-Randy Savage match that's actually given proper time and is kind of a marquee match. It's not the main event of this show, and I don't even think this was all that big, a Saturday night's main event, but it's given a lot of time, and it's an extremely satisfying bit of comfort food, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's... you know, a follow-up to a really important moment in, you know, WWE history. This is the follow-up episode that had aired about 7 weeks earlier. It was a Randy Savage Honky Tonk Man singles match. Honky Tonk Man's Intercontinental Champion. Savage is about to win the title, and then Bret and Jim the Anvil Neidhart come in and cost Savage the chance to win the title, and they gang up against him, and then the most heinous thing that was imaginable at the time, Honky Tonk Man shoves Elizabeth to the side, and she then goes and scurries to get Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan comes and saves the day, and then we get a handshake between Savage and Hogan to form the Mega Powers. So this is coming right after that, you know, the first big moment, you know, that they're Randy Savage is having and is getting a little bit of vengeance here against Bret Hart for all the shenanigans that the Hart Foundation and the Honky Tonk Man have done against Elizabeth.
This is a classic wrestling story where you have a small stable of bad guys and the good guy who clearly has trouble taking them 3-on-1. Which is, you know, even for an absolute superpower alpha good guy, would be hard. Maybe not if you're Hulk Hogan, but for someone like Savage, he always shows a little bit more humanity than your typical WWE super good guy. But he's not really a super good guy quite yet, right? This is the story that transitions him from being a fairly hated bad guy to what we would see later at WrestleMania 4, which is one of the most beloved good guy characters.
Right. And he's just, I think he's tipped over the edge right now in mm-hmm. good guy. Yeah. But he, you know, still has further to go. Is not yet completely there yet. And yeah, basically he had been pretty much since mid-August of 87, been facing villains, mm-hmm. and mostly the Honky Tonk Man, you know, at the house shows and stuff. In fact, looking at history of WWE, Savage's last match during this period against a good guy was against Hogan on August 16th in Denver. So, and that summer, pretty much he either faced heels or Hogan exclusively. So, mm-hmm. but on TV, like, it was definitely not, you know, he was not... it was clear he was transitioning. It was clear that he had fan support, but he hadn't, you know, kind of gone all the way. It was more like he was kind of half and half, but he was facing against the most hated guy in, you know, in wrestling at that point, or in WWE for sure, the Honky Tonk Man. So, you know, by default, he was the good guy in that situation.
Yeah, and I think one of the main characteristics was in those months, he kind of stopped yelling at Elizabeth.
Right.
That's like his main bad guy tactic, was yelling at Elizabeth.
Right.
Because even when he was a bad guy, she was a good guy.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So I picked this match partially because like it's a really interesting one, and it works completely by itself, even though it's a story based one, and it's a classic chapter of this story where he's going up against a group of bad guys, and he's got to pick them off one by one, right? I don't know if he actually does a one-on-one match with Jim the Anvil Neidhart during this story, but it would make sense that they would.
Yeah, I don't believe they actually did, but yes, that would definitely, that if this were happening, weekly episodic TV, in a TV type of rhythm that's happening today, that definitely would have happened at some point. It doesn't happen here, probably for the, I mean, not that it would have been fine, I'm sure, but nothing. I don't think that would have been, exciting people too much. The Jim Neidhart definitely needed Bret Hart for anyone to get, too excited about what he was doing.
Jim didn't have a whole lot of marquee singles matches.
No, not a strong suit. No. Yeah. And, the Hart Foundation, they were, among as hated as Honky Tonk Man was for a, period of time, 86 and 87, particularly, they'd been tag champs most of that time. They'd been absolutely reviled as well. I mean, Jimmy Hart really had the, Bobby Heenan was technically the number one manager, and he, would manage, obviously he managed Andre, Rick Rude, kind of the most of the marquee guys that would face off against Hogan. But Jimmy Hart, man, like in terms of like the most hated people in WWE in 1987, like he was behind them, and he was absolutely, he was definitely, 1A to Heenan's one for sure.
Oh, sure. And so easy to hate. Jimmy was so good at making even jaded, cynical wrestling fans boo that
Right.
man.
Right.
Still to this day, I
Well,
think.
he, yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, the thing about, Heenan was like the commentary almost made Heenan a little bit endearing because he was funny and people could tell that, he had his show. But there's nothing really endearing about Jimmy Hart, the character, No. Yeah. There was nothing that you could look at and be like, oh yeah, there's nothing likable about Jimmy Hart, the character. He was absolutely just, like Heenan's nickname, he was kind of a weasel,
Oh yeah, even
Yeah.
way more so than Heenan was. Although Heenan takes on this episode of Saturday Night's Main Event, Heenan takes a pretty big bump from Hogan.
Yes. Right. That's actually, I believe, the one that he's in the neck brace afterward
Yeah, for a while,
for like a year. Yeah, exactly. So
really milked that one.
yes. Yeah. Hey, might as well.
If you have a neck brace in wrestling, you're wearing that thing for a year, easy. You milk
Probably.
it. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, might as well, I mean, you should want to get those checks as long as they're coming in, those, you want to take advantage of that hazard pay.
That's right. That's
Yes.
right.
Yeah.
So I want to say just a couple of preliminary things about the interviews that happened right before this match. There were the classic Saturday Night's Main Event Gene Okerlund interviews, where the first thing I want to say is I love the backdrop where it's just glittery drapes. I feel like if you're a television producer and you have $10, that's the best backdrop you can get. And they had significantly more than $10, but they still went with glittery drapes because it's 1987. But I would say I'm on the W Network. I'm watching old stuff. The glittery drapes age so much better than almost any other background set WWE would ever use.
Hey, it's classic, glittery drapes. Can't beat
Just
it.
like after like 1997, they transition to like offices. There's always like an office in the background of WWE, and it's just these like terrible leather couches and chairs and posters and boring drapes. They're still
Right.
drapes. They never really got rid of the drapes, but the drapes
Yeah.
became very drab and boring and usually just black. And it's just really boring to look at. And this is just cheap drag queen style decoration, but there's white glittery drapes for the Macho Man and pink glittery drapes for Bret Hart. It syncs with their characters and their outfits, and I appreciate that detail.
Yeah, you could maybe trace the evolution of the set design in WWE with the increasing corporatization of the company. As Vince became much more of a corporate animal, as his company became more of a corporate animal, the aesthetic of the backstage segments, at least, probably reflect that on some level.
Agreed, agreed. Yeah. But yeah, this to me it was just like I saw that backdrop and I was just like, this is great. This is fantastic.
Yes.
And you know Okerlund in between those two interviews, Okerlund himself probably pulled one drape back and made the pink one. So or showed the white one for Savage after. And he Savage just walked in and did his thing. Right? It's a very cheap, very effective set.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. I in the actual interview itself, Brett's words are limited to "practice makes perfect." That's the only thing Brett says during the entire thing. Jimmy does most of the talking. He refers to Elizabeth as the daughter of the devil, which is a little bit that's not something I would usually use to hear like from Jimmy Hart, like maybe like Dungeon of Doom Jimmy Hart, like 10 years later. Yeah, then I could see that, but here I'm not used to Jimmy Hart speaking in those words. But I guess the idea from Jimmy is that because of course the Hart Foundation and Honky Tonk Man had put their hands on Elizabeth and so apparently he said that they were enticed to do that because some the devil made them do it, I guess. So yeah.
The she was bewitching their he, she was bewitching Jimmy Hart's men.
Right. Well, yes. Yeah.
And
So.
I mean, okay. I
Right.
don't
Yeah.
really see any video evidence of that, but all right.
Yeah. I don't know.
That's the
It's
kind of thing where it's
not.
just like, oh, boo, Jimmy Hart, you suck, man.
Right. Not cool. Yes.
Not
So.
cool.
Yeah. And yes. And then Vince definitely refers to Jimmy Hart's brood as creeps and says they're responsible for the most dastardly acts we've ever witnessed. Jesse Ventura, meanwhile, is sick of media bias and thinks that Vince is going overboard here. Although, even though he doesn't condone Honky shoving Elizabeth down, he does suggest that if she can't take it, she shouldn't be in the ring. So, kind of a best of mixed messages here from the body.
So canonical, good guy, bad guy, announcer, right? Of course, of course, Vince McMahon here in his very Tony Schiavone-esque worst thing to ever happen, exaggerations, and of course, and I don't know, man. I like with Jesse the Body Ventura. Every now and then, I'm like, I don't know, maybe she shouldn't be out there if she's not wrestling.
Well, I mean, she certainly puts, I will say, I think she belongs out there, but if she has a manager's license, I believe legally she should be there. But I do think that there is a point in which tactically it may not make the most sense for her to be there if Savage has to has to defend her while worrying about the others perhaps attacking her or intimidating her. He has to have that in the back of his mind while he's also facing his opponent. But really, that should be on WWE to provide proper security for their managers. I mean, that just kind of makes sense. Honestly, Vince is probably the one there who should maybe he's a little bit over the top with it because he realizes that he's not providing a safe workplace for his employees.
I always did appreciate whenever Ventura would criticize infrastructure issues in WWE right at Vince McMahon on commentary, talking about like this isn't how this should work.
Yes. And then Vince could always be like, "Oh yeah, we gotta talk to Jack Tunney about that."
Yeah, we gotta we'll bring that up at the next meeting.
So, anything stand out to you about the Macho Man Elizabeth interview with Gene?
I did kind of notice that even though he's not yelling at her anymore, she still looks like he's about to at any moment. She just like if there's an emotion on Elizabeth's face between the years of 1982 and 1994, it's just permanently worried, right? Like even in moments where she's really happy, like she comes down to the ring and she's smiling and stuff, but those eyes are a little afraid. I never really fully got the sense that she was ever fully comfortable on camera or in front of people or near people. I always got introvert vibes from Elizabeth. And that works for her character. She's there to be protected in a sense.
And she's there. Yeah, I mean, she is there to be protected. She's there as even before then, when Savage was a villain, she's there as kind of a foil for him to be angry at and to draw sympathy for herself and to make him even more hateable and more dastardly. And I mean, when they transitioned, you know, I thought they actually did a pretty good job of it making sense that she would still be out there and that she would still, you know, that she would provide maybe not strategy, but inspiration for him. And there would be, you know, and there would be some, you know, occasionally she did like provide distractions, you know, for the bad guys when she was a good guy. You know, WrestleMania 4, she's distracting Butch Reed when he's going up the top of the rope and let Savage win that match. So, you know, it wasn't like, you know, I don't want to put it as if she was just like useless or there for eye candy. I mean, she definitely had more than that. And she definitely had an appeal that was, you know, she was, you know, an attractive woman. But beyond that, there was appeal to her personality. People loved her. People, you know, there was something there. But I think it makes a lot of sense that she definitely did seem like an introvert. Definitely did seem like who wasn't entirely comfortable. But that discomfort actually worked well for her character.
Oh, I agree completely. And I think that's why she had a 20-year television career. I don't think she would have had that if that wasn't working, you know. Whether or not she actually wanted, I don't know her motivation, but like the her facial expressions to me always said, I'm in danger.
Right. Yes. They always, there's mayhem around me. Yeah.
Whether from Savage or the people across Savage, she's always in danger.
Yes.
And that is that's captivating television, you know.
Sure.
But it's to me, it's always been like, okay, but what, like, maybe we need to get her a heavy. I don't know.
Yeah.
Did she ever think to like hire Luna Vachon to just be her manager?
Might have been a good idea. You know, again, is this now, is her employer WWE or is her employer Macho Man? Who's responsible for providing her security in the end? You know,
never really got a full clear answer from WWE on who employs the manager, right? You know, it's always been a somewhat nebulous job.
Yes, I mean, you would think it would be directly from the wrestler, but at some point they have to be licensed by you know, WWE themselves. You would think they have to have some sort of justification. No one can just hire anybody they want to as a manager. It can't just be willy nilly. There has to be some level of, you know, I don't know. Maybe that's another,
it would be chaos. It would be chaos, right?
It would be chaos, some
kind of bureaucracy here.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how Slick ended up slipping in, but at some point, you know, he was able to, you know, so, yeah, Slick definitely seemed like somebody who just kind of walked off the street. And I mean, that was kind of the point of the character, I guess. But anyway, So, nothing, the interview, I don't think is particularly notable outside of, you know, Macho Man. Gene sort of encourages the Macho Man to be cool and not go out there like in a, you know, blaze of fury like he wants to. But Savage
does insists that, does that work out?
So when Savage and Elizabeth actually enter the ring, the hearts are already in there. But he actually prevents Liz from entering the ring as normal, being cautious. He is wearing a purple robe with sort of red orangish lining, resplendent, I would say. The hearts have pink tights with black trim, black tops, and white boots. A Macho Man has red trunks, yellow boots, and yellow knee pads.
I'll just say here, Randy Savage comes into the ring, hops over the top rope, takes off all of his stuff and throws it at Bret Hart. All of it. He's just tossing crap at Bret. Right. And then he immediately jumps all the way over the top rope to the floor for the first of, I think, three or four times he does that in this match. And he argues with Neidhart. And that's when they cut to commercial.
Yes, I did notice that when he was tossing off, you know, some of his items, he did toss the robe out. It landed in the front row, and there was a fan who touched it, and there was a WWE suit who quickly ran toward the crowd to retrieve the rope so the fan didn't take it, because they didn't care so much about the, you know, the sunglasses and headband, but the robe, they were very careful to make sure that the guy didn't end up taking. So that was an interesting little detail.
Maybe Elizabeth could hire that guy.
Yeah, there you go. that'd been smart. Right.
So we get a commercial right away before they even lock up. Right. Which I think is in terms of, if you have to cut to commercial right after the entrances, right before the match starts, that's a pretty good time. Right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I think I don't like it, nobody likes cutting to commercial as a wrestling fan, but if you got to do it, if this is national television, you have to cut to commercial at some point. Better to do it then than even 1 minute into the match, which is kind of been WWE style the last many years, is to do like 60 seconds of a match and then cut to commercial, which is always, to me, has always been frustrating.
Sure. Yeah, and you get the, of course, the benefit of pre-recording here is you don't have to, they can go right back to the action, you know, without having to edit anything out, which is nice. So yeah, when we come back, we show Brian Bosworth walking to a seat. He had played for the Seattle Seahawks at the time. They were in Seattle. I guess there are other Seahawks there. I would not know a Seahawk from 1987 outside of Brian Bosworth. And
my paranoid, my paranoid wrestling brain was like, who's this guy? Why is he in the impact zone? You know, is he going to ruin this match?
Right. Right. Yes. Yeah. This had happened 10 years later in WCW. That definitely would have happened. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Bob. Yeah. In fact, I'm kind of surprised Brian Bosworth wasn't like involved in the Savage Heart 1998 Slamboree match, you know, just to, you know, just
for continuity.
Yeah, exactly.
That would be the kind of continuity you and I would greatly enjoy that no one else would get.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That would have been lovely. But alas, we are not here. We have some pre-recorded Honky Tonk Man comments in which he insists that Brett save some of Savage for him, and also mentions that he's not finished with Liz. And he says that very effectively creepy.
Oh, real creepy, man.
There's
a lot of argument either way about whether the Honky Tonk Man was the right person to be in the role of like almost like second bad guy in WWE at this point, but I don't know, watching the footage back, he kind of makes it work.
Oh yeah, he was great. I mean, he was tremendously hated. I mean, he was hated on a level I think that is incredibly rare in WWE history. I mean, he was absolutely, you know, for a time was and was really good at being hated. I mean, he wasn't much of a wrestler, but whatever, that's fine. I mean, his matches were entertaining enough. Like, you know,
he lacked what you and I would call move speed.
Right. Yeah. He didn't have much move speed. That's true. It was not a lot of move speed, but he did, you know, what he lacked in move speed, he made up for. I mean, he certainly had a lot of hair gel. So,
yes, exactly.
So there's that. Yeah. Or maybe that was Moose. I'm not sure what product he actually used, but whatever, it made his hair, you know, look effectively shiny. So I think that made up for
him. I think really good hair gel is worth 10 arm drags.
I would say so. Yeah. It may be the fact that Ricky Steamboat had both good hair and great arm drags. You know, that was what made
him. That's why he's the legend.
That's why. Yes. Yes.
That's unstoppable.
Yes.
Except for by the Honky Tonk Man.
Right. Well, ironically, yeah.
I just want to say, how weird is it? I know it makes sense in context and during the time, but how weird is it in the sense of history that the Hart Foundation are basically just the Honky Tonk Man's goons during this period? It's so weird, right? You got to start somewhere, I guess. But they didn't start here. This was almost like their second story in WWE. It's just so weird that they're just basically playing Honky's heavies.
Right, because, you know, of course, yeah, they've been tag champions for a long time and, you know, were in stories themselves and were notable characters and did, you know, I mean, they did their own promos and stuff. But, yeah, they're definitely second been added to Honky here. I mean, this is, I think this is a situation that is emerging. I mean, this is definitely Brett's biggest, you know, most high profile singles match of his career at this point. And, I mean, he's been in wrestling for, I think, you know, 8-9 years. He's been in WWE for, you know, about 3 years or so, 3.5 years, mostly as a tag wrestler with Neidhart. He did have a brief singles run to start off with, but that didn't go very well. But I mean, this match is going to help him emerge from, you know, being one of Honky's heavies or being, you know, known as a tag wrestler, and is going to kind of vault him into another, level eventually. But, obviously it takes a while, and yeah, it is, you know, given, you would have no sense from this match right here that Bret Hart would go on to be one of the most important wrestlers, you know, of the 90s.
No, it's, you know, when I'm assuming it wasn't surprising to you that I would pick a Bret Hart match, but this kind of isn't a Bret Hart match. He's in it, but he's not really Bret Hart yet. And this isn't even about him. He's like the third most important character in his stable at this point.
Right. Yes.
you know?
No, yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, the actual action, it is a very much a Bret Hart match. But yeah, that's very secondary to the rest of the drama that is happening here. You know, we start off with basically Savage chasing the Harts from the ring. He and Bret fight outside for a little bit, and then Bret is sent into the ring post for the first time, not the last in this match, no. And moves slowly into the ring. Then Savage works on Bret in the corner, grabs onto his face while the referee is counting, still willing to bend the rules despite, you know, again, depending on your point of view, either having turned to the good side or in the midst of turning to the good side, and never really, you know, gave that up. I mean, pretty much as a good guy, he was pretty much willing to, he would cheat basically as much as possible. I don't recall him ever, like, you know, foregoing an opportunity to cheat.
Randy Savage has a sort of scratch and claw style to his wrestling, right? Where he, like, right. anything he can get his hands on, anything he can grab onto, it doesn't matter to him. He's never really particularly cared about being disqualified or the rules or anything. He's there to survive almost. We get more of that later in the match when he's completely debilitated. But even at the beginning, even at the onset, at his full powers, he's just like, whatever he can do, you know, it's always been this amazing sense of timing and desperation that it really does put you in his corner.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and he was really, you know, as I talked about before, he was so, not only personality-wise, but style-wise, he was so effective at being somebody who, you know, could draw that sympathy from his offensive style, but also could be, you know, just completely be like a wild man, like completely be somebody, you know, who could, you know, obviously, like, come from the top rope and drop somebody's neck over the rail, or drop a bell on somebody's neck, or really inflict damage with his wildness, but also, you know, draw sympathy with, you know, it's kind of two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great. There's a moment fairly early on, and I think he does this twice in the match, where he gets, Bret goes to the outside, like, really early on, Bret goes to the outside, and Savage perches atop the top rope, and the camera is looking up at him from below, and he just looks so fucking rad, right? Just yes. Incredible. This is an incredible image. And if you're there live, or if you're watching this on Saturday night in 1987, you're going to remember that image forever. That guy's always going to look amazing to you.
Yeah, and he was so quick here. I mean, he was just so, like, quick and agile and like a cat, really. I mean, it was just he had such so balance fast. Yeah, and moved so well, you know, incredibly well. And you know, we get to a point where, you know, they kind of go back and forth for a while, and then Savage is able to knock Bret over with a running elbow, and then Bret ends up on the apron, and Randy charges and from the opposite ropes and shoves him from the apron, flying into the barricade.
Usually,
Bret did this famous,
I love it. Yeah, right. It's such a good Bret Hart, like, taking someone else's offense move. It just looks like he's been murdered, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's definitely taken, you know, by far the biggest amount of punishment here. He's taken all, you know, they've gone back and forth, but he's taken, you know, most of the big moves. At this point, Jimmy Hart and the Anvil jump onto the apron, so Macho knocks their heads together. And then after some shenanigans, Savage goes to the top while Bret is still on the floor, but Bret happens to be holding the megaphone and is hiding it, and then knocks Savage with it as Savage comes down. So finally, Bret is able to take a little bit of control. He ties Savage up in the Tree of Woe. Savage does free himself, but then Bret follows up with a strong pile driver, which only gets two. But
so brutal.
Yeah.
Oh my God, such a brutal pile driver. I just want to say, going back a second, I love a double noggin knocker.
Oh,
It's one of my favorite old school moves that just, you never see it anymore, and I miss that one.
Yeah.
You never see it because it's cartoony and silly, but it's, you know, sure. I feel like you could do. I feel like with a well-timed one would extremely pop a crowd these days. I would also say young wrestlers should watch this match. This should be in the classroom. This should be in the curriculum for a match with not a ton of wrestling moves. Like, there are wrestling moves in this match, but it's so much more a lesson in timing and how to really have a grudge match where one person is supposedly way more powerful than the other person, but it still ends up feeling even.
Right. Yeah. And Savage gives Brett a lot here. And also Brett takes a lot of punishment and comes back.
Oh my God, does he ever.
Right. So, you know, I think that's in a sense shows him strong. I mean, they really put over his technical ability, which they always did. Jesse in particular did that. Mm-hmm. And they're not really surprised that Brett is doing so well. I mean, you know, because he's, you know, he's been a tag champion. He's, you know, a reasonably high level wrestler, reasonably well known wrestler, but obviously been in the tag situation and on some level. It's kind of supposed to be near Savage's level, but I think most fans would have not seen that. So,
no way, There's been no presentation of him at that level yet.
Right, and I think it's better, actually, that they don't call attention to it, that they just kind of let him be at that level without really, like, hammering home that, oh, yeah, Brett's doing really well here, you know?
Exactly.
I think it's better, yeah. Yeah, and Brett's, you know, he's obviously contrast of styles with these guys. He's, you know, Brett's methodical in his attack, not boring at all, but just very, you know, he's kind of alternating strikes and different wrestling moves. He misses a charge to the corner and then slips and his head hits the second turnbuckle. And then Savage immediately tosses him into the other corner with Brett's shoulder hitting the ring post again.
Oh my God. It felt like I, oh my God, that was, it just looked so devastating. Like, I'm almost not used to Savage's offense feeling like he's killing the other guy, right? I'm really much more used to Savage wrestling at his own level or from below, frankly.
Right.
But this is a match where clearly Savage is much stronger and has much more motivation to hurt the other guy. And you're right, Brett just takes such a beating. Oh my God. Like that, yeah, that shoulder into the post, Brett looks like he's dead. Like,
yeah,
it's amazing. Yeah. Such a lesson in selling, but not necessarily overselling. Like, these moves look like they're hurting that much.
Yeah, and it looks, and the way, I always liked Brett's style of selling because it was more of, okay, it's more of an accumulation of fatigue and pain. And, yeah, I mean, he would sell a body part occasionally, but it was more like, it was more subtle. Like, it wasn't like over the top type of, you know, it was more just, you know, you saw it, you noticed it, but it wasn't hammering your head over with it, unless it was situations where that was warranted.
Right after this, there's such an amazing sequence where Savage, like, just basically runs from one end of the ring to the other, like, three times in a row, where he guillotines Bret Hart, where he sort of, like, he jumps over the top rope, hits the floor on his feet for the second time, right, while guillotining Bret on the top rope, dashes back into the ring, pie faces the referee who's trying to slow things down, right, and then Bret clotheslines him over the top rope again, making him land on his feet for the third time.
Right, and that's the point where Savage hurts his left ankle, which is kind of the turning point of the match. Yes.
And so I want to talk about this a little bit here because I tried to do some research on what happened here. So Brett clotheslines him over the top rope, effectively eliminating him from the Royal Rumble. And then Savage is hurt, right? Savage is clearly very hurt. They take a commercial break, which during this point in time is a sense that something's gone wrong, even though it was pre-recorded. And they come back to exactly the same moment. Or maybe a few moments later, because during the commercial break, Savage is taken off his boot.
Right. Well, right. Elizabeth helps him untie the boot as we go to commercial break. And then Jimmy Hart and Anvil are kind of mocking Randy, like, oh, you're not really hurt or whatever, you know. And then, right. When we come back, I think Savage has the boot off, but it's probably just a few moments later. He's sort of struggling to pull himself into the ring, unable to put weight on the ankle, you know, holding it in pain. Jesse sort of suggests that he should quit, but yeah, very much at this point now, okay, the ankles hurt, but we're continuing the match. He's going to put up the fight, you know, or try to put up a good fight.
Absolutely. So I did some research. I couldn't find a second narrative about this because the main narrative is he really hurt his ankle here.
Right. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
But he doesn't seem to take any time off after this.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that this was... I remember Brett addressing this in his... I can't remember if it was his book or it was an interview or what it was. But, I mean, Brett basically... You know, because the interesting thing, about Savage, and you wouldn't really know that from his wrestling style, but Savage was well known for wanting to pre-plan his matches to a large degree and plan things out in advance, where Brett was more of a, you know, kind of a freelance, more, you know, plan a few things, but, you know, kind of call it in the ring type thing, which given mm-hmm. their styles is sort of an interesting contrast. But anyway,
maybe
they had
one of the reasons they didn't work together all that often.
Maybe not. Yeah. But, you know, so they had something planned out that they really, really excited about. Like they had a match that Brett thought was going to be amazing and was really, you know, Brett obviously knew that this was a, you know, big, you know, an important match for him, a chance for him to showcase, you know, his ability as a singles wrestler. And he probably had that motivation. So, but I think, you know, it's very soon before the match is going to go on that Vince is like, no, you know, don't do that. I want you to, you know, we want to have, Randy hurt his ankle and, you know, have that be the story of the match. And so, you know, and Brett's like, oh, I've never done that before. And then Vince is like, well, you're the great worker, figure it out, you know? And Brett took that as, you know, motivation for it's kind of a, both you know, motivation to figure it out. And also some indication that Vince had confidence in him to do that. So, I think I don't think there's anything. Yeah, it doesn't really play into the left ankle is not an issue after this match at all. That I recall, you know, they're not doing anything afterward that would reflect that. Of course, they're not having, you know, Savage isn't on TV every week either. So I don't know the next time that he was on Superstars or whatever, but it may have been a few weeks later. You may have just figured, oh, yeah, it healed, whatever. But it doesn't really play anything into anything else outside of the context of just, you know, is what's going to happen over the next few minutes.
You know how comforting that is to me? Because this really feels like, holy shit, he killed his ankle. Like he does an excellent job of making it look like his leg is broken. Right. He can barely stand, and I don't mean like he's hobbling, like he's unable to become vertical.
Right.
And he's trying really, really hard.
Yeah, that's a momentous struggle to even just to get up and put the and just to be able to move it all. You know, he's limping, obviously, basically not putting any weight on the ankle. And then Brett, you know, obviously attacks the ankle right away, slams it into the post. You know, Vince is saying, hey, we should let's stop the match. You know, this is too much for him. And then Brett does a few spinning toe holds with Savage kicking him away. And then Macho is able to get a quick cover off of, you know, a neck snap off of the ropes, but only gets two there. Brett immediately goes back to the ankle, locks in a half clap, but Randy gets the rope. So it's kind of a theme of, you know, Brett focusing on the ankle, Randy just trying to survive here and, you know, getting himself into bad situations, but being able to escape them. But, you know, it looks like his moments are numbered.
It's amazing. And, you know, there's a moment here where I'm like, if only Brett had a leg based finishing move.
Yeah.
You know, he could really put him away with something here.
Sure. Yeah. Well, only there was something that he was known for that, you know, was effective on the legs.
But you know what? It's amazing to me because so you need to have matches like this where the leg does seem really hurt so that later you can have a WrestleMania 20 main event where Eddie Guerrero does the exact same thing,
right?
But it's a fake out, you know?
Yes. Right.
Like that is, you know, that's one of so many people's favorite matches ever. The Kurt Angle, Eddie Guerrero, WrestleMania 20 match.
Sure.
But that hurt ankle is a callback to matches like this. I don't know if it's specifically to this one, but this isn't the only time someone's hurt their leg and had to take a boot off, you know?
Yeah.
It's such a good move, and it's such like it's. I count that as a wrestling move. If you hurt your, if you take off a boot, that's a wrestling move in
That's
terms
what it
of,
is.
yeah.
That counts for his move speed. That's what you're saying.
That
Yeah.
counts for the move speed.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Good. I'm glad. Right. Savage has
Yeah.
improved his move speed. So that's good.
His
We'll.
move speed is already pretty crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll mark that one on the ledger. We'll
Yes,
calculate that
should.
one later. Yeah. So,
Yeah.
yes. So, and Savage again, not afraid to cheat a little bit, rakes the face to get a quick respite on Brett. He crawls to the apron. Brett grabs him, body slams him in, but then Savage holds on for an inside cradle, which gets a three count and the win. Ironically, yeah, variation of the move that cost him the Intercontinental Championship to Steamboat. So
So
he
good.
earned. Yeah, right.
In informed and historically in context finishing moves is one of the greatest things in the world. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It just is.
Right. No, it's fantastic. Yeah.
A
He's
wrestling match that ends with a thing that makes you go, they learned from their own history.
Yes.
Amazing.
Right. And Savage is one of the few wrestlers who actually got smarter as a good guy than he was as a bad guy. So
It's one of the reasons we love him. It's one of the reasons we love Bret Hart, Eddie Guerrero, like the really, really good wrestlers who really care about this craft. They would do things like that in their matches that made people who have been paying attention for a while really appreciate it.
absolutely. So we get a little bit of post-match as Anvil and Jimmy pounce right away, but Savage is able to fend them off after Jimmy accidentally nails Brett with a megaphone. Savage ends up holding the megaphone in the ring as he's laying down and tending to his ankle, and he lifts it high as he's announced the winner of the match, which is a really cool detail.
Is
And
there a better theme song to play after like a hero fights off the bad guys after a post-match attack than Randy Savage's? I don't think there is.
right.
You
Well,
know?
I agree. So what is your favorite Randy Savage post-match celebration, the theme, the thing coming up as Savage is doing something, heroic or recovering or whatever. What's your favorite moment that you can think of?
He almost does this exactly again at WrestleMania 8, right? This
Right.
is
Yes.
if you look at the WrestleMania 8 ending, it's very, very similar to this. So there's the roll up, there's the immediate beat down by the second at WrestleMania 8, it's Mr. Perfect.
Right.
And it's Savage beats them off. He holds on to something. There's usually a prop. The prop is very important to Savage, I found.
Yes. Yeah.
And he holds it, and only after the bad guys have left and his name is said as the winner does the music come on.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Almost no other wrestler has their theme song wait.
Right. Yeah. No, it definitely. Yeah, it's a perfect dramatic moment for that. Yeah,
Yeah.
obviously it echoes WrestleMania 8. And the cool thing about the WrestleMania 8 is that you're not 100% sure that they're gonna count the match as Savage winning the match. Like you feel like there's still like a chance that like, oh, maybe he could have been disqualified, or maybe like they did, because he yeah you obviously you saw him pin Flair, but after all the post-match shenanigans, you're not 100% sure he's going to be called the winner. So when he he's actually announces the winner and Elizabeth is there, and and he's holding the belt, and and you have the moment trap. Yeah, that's perfect. I mean, nothing's ever going to beat WrestleMania 7 with he and Liz embracing as the song comes on and all that, but that's absolutely close, and this is a standout one as there. I'm gonna as we do more of these, I'm gonna have to try to pick out a few of those great moments. Post-match, his theme comes on, celebration type things. So
I wonder, is that part of it? Is that so Savage plans his matches out? Does he plan out all of the production around it as well? Is he talking to the camera guy and saying, you need to zoom in at this point? You need to play the music at this point. Is that part of his whole thing?
I wonder. I mean, I don't know that. I know I haven't. Obviously, he was not a person who did a lot of interviews after his career, and and write a book, or hasn't, as far as I know, was unable to give his thoughts on that on those type of things before he passed away. So, that is an excellent question. I mean, I would assume that wrestlers who are smart and care about their craft and are thinking about this type of stuff, that's the type of stuff they're thinking about. And I'm sure Savage was at a level at this point where he could have weighed in on that and he would have been listened to. But that's an excellent question. I don't know.
I have to think he would have at least tried, you know. But right. the fact that he has multiple matches that end in these kind of ways, and that you know, his theme song plays at different times, and you know, even the commentators say certain things that make me go, I feel like that was actually part of the script in order to be set at that moment. It makes me think, like, yeah, Savage probably planned more than just his moveset, right? More than just the beats. Right. And maybe I'm giving him too much credit. I don't know. But I will say I've always appreciated Savage's approach. I've always, because I like to rewatch wrestling matches, and oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, the matches that age best were the ones that had more thought put into them. That might be shocking to some people, but I find that to be the case.
Yeah, and I think the fact that Savage, he was so good in the ring, obviously, but he was so good at, you know, the stuff after, the stuff before, the extras that, mm-hmm. you know, make, that are, you know, that aren't part of the meal, but that spice up the meal. You know, he was so good at that kind of stuff, and that kind of stuff absolutely, you know, I think sets him apart from some other, you know, great wrestlers, you know, of his time, because I think he did that stuff, you know, better or as well as anybody.
Yeah. So like you said you're going to go back and watch a bunch of Savage matches as comfort food. I think he's one of the best performers to go back and rewatch because of this, because he puts so much care into the entire performance. And I think he probably annoyed a lot of other wrestlers, because that's kind of not how wrestling worked.
Right. Right. Yeah.
You know, I feel like he was not just ahead of his time, but like 30, 40 years ahead of his time in terms of, let's think about this like a storyboard, like an actual scene we're shooting, you know. From what I understand, a lot of wrestlers still don't look at it that way.
Sure.
So, you know, and that's why I think a lot of wrestling is still pretty boring. thank you for indulging me on this one. I love this match. There's such and we didn't even talk about the crowd, but the crowd is so alive for this match. It's deafening in there. And I don't know how much of that is WWE piping in crowd music, but I don't think all that much with this one.
No, I think, yeah, I think people were definitely into this. They were definitely into, you know, Savage at this point and that story. So, I get the sense that it didn't seem like there was the normal type of, you know, WCW Saturday Night overdubbing that we would, that would sometimes be a part of these. It seemed like there was a lot of genuine excitement there. I want to transition a little bit to the other interactions that Randy Savage and Bret Hart had in their careers. Because as you mentioned, not that much, really. They had a total of 4 singles matches. This is their first. And then they also had one in 1990, March of 1990. That would have been when, Randy was the Macho King right before WrestleMania 6. Bret actually beat Savage by count out. And then
I'm guessing he took his belt and ran away.
Probably, yeah.
That's likely what happened.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I would say that. Then 1994, Bret is champion. May of 1994, when Bret was champion, he beat Randy Savage in Yokohama, Japan at a house show. I don't know if there's any – I don't think there's any video of that one, but that would be an interesting one to say. The other one they had one. Did I overlook one? They had one in South Bend, Indiana in 1990. That was the one by count out. I forgot to mention that was South Bend, Indiana. And then the fourth one was Slamboree 1998 with a special guest referee, Roddy Piper. And this was Savage trying to get revenge on Bret for costing him the WCW title a month before against Hogan, when Bret turned on WCW. Well, didn't really join the NWO. He became an allies with Hulk Hogan.
Mm-hmm.
So, Yeah,
That one doesn't have the same amount of shine, I think.
No, it's not bad. I rewatched. I tried to find any video of any matches that you know they had interactions with each other, and I found a few. I'll talk about them in a minute. But yeah, the action's still pretty good. Savage was dealing with a knee injury that he would end up being out for a year to deal with. So that slowed him down. Plus, you know, he was definitely slowed down at that point anyway. But like I said, the action's not bad, but it gets there's a lot of unnecessary NWO shenanigans in it. Piper's actually fine as the guest referee. He was known for ruining matches as referee. In this case, he's actually okay. But just some silliness, you know, that was endemic of the time of WCW lessened that one. And they could have, like, accomplished the same thing, but still cut out, like, 70% of the silliness. And I think everyone would have been happier.
I wonder, how many times has Roddy Piper refereed a Bret Hart match?
That is an interesting question.
I don't think the database is going to help us with this one.
I guess not. Yeah. By the way, I'm using cagematch.net database. I forgot to mention that.
Generally a very good resource. A very good resource. And I'm sorry, but if you need a database destroyed by a weird question, I'm the guy to call.
Because
I'm like, here I am searching for special referee Roddy Piper, and it's not something that they will. It's not something they'll give you. Maybe I've got to find the right pivot table for that one.
Maybe, yeah, yeah. The special referee pivot table. That's a tough one.
Referee pivot table.
Right. Yeah. It's yes. Yeah. So they had a few beyond that singles match. They had a couple of tag matches in WCW around this time. Actually, one like a month beforehand, where like everyone involved in the match was on different sides because everyone was turning every week in WCW at that point. And then a month later, it was Savage and Piper against Bret and Hogan. I believe the only time that Bret and Hogan they might have teamed on TV a few other times, but the first time they ever teamed, and the first time Savage and Piper ever teamed either. Not an okay-ish match, but nothing special. And then, you know, for the most part, you know, they there's one where they're teaming. There's a Bret Hart and Randy Savage versus Flair and Shawn Michaels, 1992 match. That's pretty fun that, you can find on, I think it's on the network actually. If not, I definitely saw it on Daily Motion. And then from 88, there were a bunch of, matches with Savage and Strikeforce against Honky Tonk Man and the Hart Foundation, and one of them, a cage match, is available on Daily Motion as well. So, not much Savage Hart interaction there, but fun enough match.
Mm-hmm. I do wonder if and I think one of the questions we're going to get here is about this, but if there isn't something that really kept them apart. I don't know if it was age or if it was just status in the company, but if I had to guess, it might have been match style. Like, it might have been, how does this employee work versus how does this employee work?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. 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 I think it may have just been, I think it was just mostly situational. It just happened to be the fact that they were in different phases of their careers for the most part, and there wasn't really a great reason to put them together.
Yeah.
I mean, they definitely could have, but there wasn't really, you know.
Because obviously they do interlink a few times, so it's not like there's any. I don't think there's any personal reasons or anything like that. But
right.
I think it's just like often wrestlers perform with other wrestlers who have similar working styles, not necessarily wrestling styles, but working styles. Like, how do they do this job?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So let's get to some of the questions. We got a lot of good ones here, actually.
Good ones.
Yeah. Well, we always have good questions. I shouldn't be surprised.
Oh yeah. They're all good questions. They're all very handsome questions.
Yes. They're lovely questions. So, let's see. Star of Savage gave us a couple of questions. Let's see. So Savage famously wanted to work an extensive feud with Michaels circa 1992-93, but ended up dropping the belt to Flair and ultimately leaving. Would that program have cut out Hart's ascension? Do you think Savage thought Hart didn't need the rub? I wasn't aware that Savage wanted to do a feud with Michaels. That's really interesting. If that would have been like a world title feud or just more of, like, I feel like that wouldn't have been a good world title feud, but that would have been a good, you know, kind of passing the torch, you know, mid-level type thing with kind of, you know, Michaels ascending to the next level and Savage, you know, kind of giving him the thing. I mean, I think Flair and Hart would have been was better at that time, and I think it kind of worked out better the way that it did. But what are your thoughts?
I agree, and I think mostly history was right on this one. I think WWE was right on this one by sort of making Michaels take a slightly longer route than Brett at the time. I think that mostly worked out. I think Shawn Michaels had one or two WWF championship matches in 92, and that was fine. It was, and they were clearly sort of written as he's a young, hungry jerk.
Right.
But he's not actually at that level yet. And that's, I think that was actually the right thing to do. I think overall, having Shawn Michaels be the main eventer in like 95 on was the right call. And I don't know. I've seen Savage and Michaels in the ring together. They're fine. But I don't understand why those two characters would ever have anything to do with each other.
Yeah, I think 93, 94... I could see it making sense. I mean, just because, you know, obviously they are, you know, Michaels is the kind of guy that Savage was, you know, 7-8 years ago. So, you know, Savage is seeing kind of a reflection of his former self. I mean, of course, he also, you know, Michaels explicitly has Savage's former manager, who he has, you know, a very, ugly split with, you know, at WrestleMania 7. So, you know, I can see some feelings there being dredged up, especially with Elizabeth out of the picture and not really, you know, having anything to do with it now. You know, maybe Sherry wants, you know, Michaels to go after Savage. Maybe Sherry sees, you know, Savage as, you know, maybe vulnerable, maybe a stepping stone for her, you know, her man, and she knows him very well. You know, that.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Now I'm thinking, Sherry could have made it interesting. Like, that would have actually given them an historical foothold. That could have been pretty good. God knows it would have been better than anything else that happened in 1993.
Right.
But
yeah, right. Yes. Exactly. Yeah.
But that to me is one of those, like, that's almost an introspective story. And the WWE was a few years away from being able to do stuff like that, I think.
Yeah, you're probably right. I mean, I definitely think they could have made something fun out of it, interesting out of it. I agree that the times they interacted, like in tag matches and in situations, it wasn't like there was anything that was overwhelmingly great. But yeah, I'm sure it would have. I mean, it would have been at least really interesting. At minimum, I'm sure it probably would have been really good because, you know, they were still both really good at that point.
Yeah.
Stephen Graham asks, after seeing this match, how great would Savage Brett have been at WrestleMania 9?
Sure. I mean, sure.
I don't think anything would have been great at WrestleMania 9. I just don't think that was going to be a possibility.
You think it was going to be a cursed show no matter what they did?
Pretty much.
Can I tell you a quick story?
Absolutely.
So we're, you know, one of the reasons we're doing this is because, you know, the world has gone to hell and everybody's quarantined.
Right.
And so we're trying to have some fun. This is some good stuff, I think. This is, if you've got podcast pals, man, now's the time. This is, we've been preparing for this. maybe a few weeks before this all happened, I went down to this bar on the east side of Toronto, and there was going to be like a trivia thing. And it was one of those bars that just every now and then plays old VHS tapes. Like, there's a little bit of a hipster vibe, you know. And I walk in, and what do I see on a giant wall from a projector is WrestleMania 9 on VHS. Ooh. And they just started playing it as I walked in. And I'm like, oh, this is not going to go well. this is an omen. And I'm like, this goddamn thing will curse me for the rest of my life. This show is literally haunting me now. So I thought I would share that one here if it came up.
Yeah.
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 And of course,
yeah.
Like I'm sitting at the bar and this projector is actually streaming through the bar a little bit. Like it's a cool effect, but it just means like WrestleMania in line is literally hitting me in the face most of the night.
Yeah. No, I think I don't know if WrestleMania 9 would have been exactly the right time. I mean, I'm sure it would have been a good match. I'm sure they could have done something with it, but I just don't think that like, I don't know if a good guy versus good guy passing the torch thing would have been the best thing for Bret at that point. And I think it would have been too soon for Savage to be a villain. Again, you know, I mean, yeah, I guess it had been 3 years, so I guess he could have gone back, you know, or 2 years. What I actually thought, and we got this question, was asked by Dale Mac 25 about the idea of having Macho fill the Bob Backlund role in 1994 and then try to do that. And I do think that's really interesting.
That is interesting. I don't think Savage would have ever agreed to do a story like that. And isn't that kind of one of the reasons he left? It's because they kind of didn't like they didn't want him to be Randy Savage anymore. They wanted him to, you know, become an sort of an elder statesman character, and he right. didn't want any part of that. And so I think that would have gone against anything Savage wanted to do with his career.
Yeah. So you think the idea that like. Because to do that story, you have to acknowledge that Savage is no longer in his prime, that he's like a little past his prime, and you think that would have not been, you know, the, yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I think Savage would have done really well. I think it might have been more effective than Backlund, because, I mean, Backlund was really good in that role, and part of the reason that worked so well is because Backlund basically came out of nowhere and like was
yes.
you know, gone for basically a decade. And then you know, no one kind of knew what he did. And then he came back and was this vanilla guy. So it was just a real contrast to that. And he pulled it off real well, but Savage, just the skills that he had and the versatility that he had, if he'd been willing to do it, I think it would have been really effective.
Sure.
And I think in a different way, but probably I think that would have been maybe even more memorable thing that would have been able to do. And I think Savage as a villain again, kind of doing like the Terry Funk and Ric Flair thing in 89, you know, Savage kind of doing a version of that. I think that would have been, you know, and I could see Bret being a little bit dismissive of Savage. It's like, oh yeah, you know, you haven't really been full time here. You know, you just been kind of, you know, hosting the beginning of Raw and, you know, introducing Lex Luger and wearing American flag suits, but, you know, you're not really belonging here type of thing. I think that would have, I think that would have been a really good story.
Yeah, sure. I mean, where were we when they were writing 1993's wrestling calendar, you know?
I don't know. So, Art Between the Ropes asked, if you could have 87 Savage feud with any wrestler from any time, what would be your top choice? His top choice is 2004 Eddie Guerrero.
That's great. You know, I like these. And remember those, like, there was a video game, I want to say in 2012 or 2013, where they had, like, it was WWE All-Stars, I think.
Okay.
And it was, like, and they sort of picked like they're like the ideal time period for all of the wrestlers. So like sure. it was like 87 Savage and 84 Hogan. And, you know, it was like 1990 Mr. Perfect. Like it was like, it was not accurate at all, but I don't enjoy WWE video games that try to be accurate because they forget that wrestling's, scripted entertainment. And they try to treat it like a sport and it's weird. I thought All-Stars was actually really fun. I like that question where it's like, take prime version of this character and put them up against anybody. I think that pretty much anyone who could wrestle well would have a great story against 87 Savage.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I think 2014 Daniel Bryan would be a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think 2005 Samoa Joe would be a lot of fun.
Okay.
I think that 2016 Sasha Banks would be a lot of fun.
Okay. There you go.
That's me. I think like 2016 Kenny Omega would be a lot of fun. You know, pretty much anybody who's incredible. But the thing is, 87 Savage is incredible. So it's a top tier list. Like, it's an S tier list.
Back when I was young and would foolishly do fantasy booking, one of the stories that I wanted to do was like 98 Savage and Eddie Guerrero, with Guerrero recreating, you know, dropping the ring bell on Savage, you know, recreating the Ricky Steamboat thing, and then basically doing that with Eddie as the villain. I thought that would be a really good story.
I wish wrestling would do reruns more often. And by reruns, I mean like straight up references. Like, let's just do this story again. Let's just run Savage Steamboat again. That's just a good story. You should just do that every 10 years, you know?
Right, right.
Like, leave good stories in the past. Do them again. People like to see that, you know?
Sure. And obviously there has to be a certain amount of distance because you can't do it all the time. But, you know, something 10 years later is absolutely fair game to.
And wrestling fans' memories are longer than most people give them credit for. So it's usually appreciated.
Right. And even if it's not, it's such a great thing. It just works on its own without you having to get the reference. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I like wrestling when it works on multiple levels, you know?
Exactly.
And one of the ways to get to multiple levels is to just do the same story again, but with new characters in a new context. So things will obviously be a little different. You know, if you do Savage and Steamboat in 2017 NXT, it's going to be different, right? It won't be the exact same story, but the bones of it will be the same, and people will appreciate that. I honestly don't know why we don't get more of those. We do from time to time. You do get nice reflection stories, but I don't know why it isn't used more.
Maybe they don't remember them very well. You know, maybe that's,
could be that.
That could definitely be it. Yeah. Okay, two more. Colm Kearns had... WWF persisted with the brief Brett singles run of 1988. How do you think it would have turned out? Would Vince eventually have more faith in Brett as a top guy rather than seeing him as someone whose ascent came from circumstances beyond his control, aka the steroid scandal? So I, you know, for a little bit more context here, you know, Brett after WrestleMania 4 had a singles run, and Neidhart did too, that lasted, you know, maybe 6 or so months. You know, he feuded mostly with Bad News Brown and you know, lost most of those matches, and then the Hart Foundation ended up kind of back together late at the end of 88 or into 89, and we're a tag team basically for the next couple years. So, you know, and I guess the idea here is that, you know, maybe because later on, of course, Brett ends up, you know, being chosen as the champion for a lot of reasons. One, you know, because he's been a loyal soldier. I mean, he has a certain level of popularity, but I don't think he was Vince's ideal choice at the time. He was just kind of the one guy that he could count on, which I think was a lot of, you know, kind of the context for what later led to, you know, the, souring of their relationship. But what are your thoughts?
Who was Bret Hart in 1988? Like, what's his character? What's his motivation? What's he doing there? What does he want? What's stopping him? What are his obstacles? I don't know that any of those questions were really well answered in 1988 for Bret Hart.
Right.
And I think that's what stopped it. I think that's why it didn't work. That's usually why things don't work, is... Like, the match we just talked about, within three sentences, I can tell you what Savage wants, what his obstacles are, and what he's going to get if he gets what he wants. These are, and it should be that easy. And even though it was a fantastic match and a great storyline, at every chapter of that story, those questions should be that easy. I don't remember 1988 Bret Hart. And I was a kid who loved Bret Hart in the 80s.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I remember that he was mad at Bad News Brown for breaking his trophy. That was pretty much the extent of, you know, of what I remember from Bret in 88. Yeah, I don't know if it was that he just didn't quite have the connection yet with fans for it to work, or if he just kind of put in bad circumstances, or what that failure was. But I don't know. I mean, I think it pretty much worked about as well for Bret eventually as it could have. But yeah, I don't know if they'd gone to him earlier, if that would have, because, you know, they went to him when WWE was starting to fail rather than going to him when they were still succeeding strongly. And maybe that might have, you know, helped their transition to the new era. I mean, they tried it with Warrior, but Warrior was just such an unstable personality. And then when they, and Bret was kind of the next guy they picked for the next generation. But by then it was just sort of, you know, it was going to take time to recover everything because things had fallen so far.
I think the main thing too was that, like, Bret Hart is a human being, and none of those other guys are human beings. Like Hulk Hogan, Macho Man Randy Savage, Ultimate Warrior, these guys are not like humans. They're like set as like Greek demigods, like in WWE. Like, if you're watching this, you're like surprised that any of them ever go home, have a life, and have a I can't picture any of those people like owning a television, you know, or having a wife. Like, these things were true, but I can't picture them based on WWE television, right? I can't picture them driving a car or buying an airplane ticket. Like, that just doesn't make sense, right? But Bret Hart, I'm like, oh yeah, that totally, right? That guy knows how to rent a car in an airport, no problem.
Sure.
And I think in 1988 there was just no room at the top for a normal human being. I think the Million Dollar Man Ted DiBiase was the most normal human being at the top at that moment.
Right.
And that's saying a lot, right?
Yes.
Because his superpower was just capitalism.
Right. Right. Yes. He truly a character for our times. You know,
it's almost weird that he wasn't a babyface in like 1990. You know, that it's almost weird historically that Vince never made DiBiase like a good rich guy, or never tried.
No, yeah, because that seems like something that naturally would have happened. Yeah. Right. No.
Like in 89 after WrestleMania 5, like Trump walks up to Vince and he's like, "What about this DiBiase guy? He's gonna be the hero next year, right?"
Yeah. Yeah. Just find, you know, some socialist to, you know, be his, you know, his villain, you know, and you got going right there, you know? Yeah. You really? Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I've just created a horrible alternate universe.
You have. You really have. Yeah. Some, you know, you just got to get somebody that looks a little bit like Bernie Sanders. You make it work, you know? So.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think we got through most of the good questions. So appreciate everyone for sending them in.
I love it.
So yeah. Sorry. Anything you want to let people know that you're working on before we close it?
I'm a semi-retired podcaster. no, not really. I just kind of want everybody to stay safe and. I will say this is a great time to get into podcasting if you haven't done it before. There are so many great ways to like make a podcast now that you and I didn't have access to 10 years ago. It's so much easier to make a blog now that has audio embedding. It's so much easier to just do it on your phone. Like if you have an iPhone or an Android phone, you can make a podcast. You are not... you don't need a big computer. You don't need like a lot of hardware to do this kind of thing. The barrier for entry is much lower. So if I have anything to say to people, it's like grab a friend and make a podcast. I think that is one of the best things you can do right now.
Yeah. I mean, don't literally grab your friend. Let your friend.
No. You know. Yeah. I mean, yes. Yeah. Like
metaphorically, grab your friend. Yeah.
Send them an electronic message and do a podcast.
Yes.
there are things you can do to make your podcast better. Like you can buy a microphone and stuff like that. But honestly, these days, like the microphone on your phone is pretty good.
Yeah.
It should not be a reason to not do it is what I'm saying. Like, you know, after your 50 episodes in, if you want to upgrade your stuff, upgrade your stuff. But there's no reason for you not to record 50 episodes with a pal right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Everyone should, follow their dreams. You know, the fact that I managed to make a podcast with, you know, more than 200 episodes about wrestling seems absurd to me. So if I can do it,
amazing achievement. It's an amazing achievement and you should be very proud of it.
Well, thank you very much. And obviously, hey, you've been a big part of this show, been on a lot of episodes. We've done some cool stuff together and hopefully we'll continue to do cool things together in the future.
Absolutely, man. I'm always here.
All right. Cool. Well, thanks everyone for listening. You can find us at Twitter. We'll include our Twitter info in the show notes. And yeah, so everyone stay safe out there and we'll be back again soon.